Good afternoon, again. Please forgive that I'm trying to speak in English. I would like to introduce Mr. Richard Stallman, who would like to tell you something about software patents.
Please raise your hands if you cannot hear me. Okay, now I can tell people can hear me. I am generally known for my work developing free software and the GNU operating system that most people unfortunately think is Linux. But that's not what I'm here to speak about today. I want to speak about a danger that threatens all developers of software and all users of computers. This is the danger of patents on software ideas. I'm not talking about patenting programs. People often misunderstand the issue. Patenting a specific program would actually make no difference at all, because the program is copyrighted anyway, and such a patent would be a narrower monopoly than the copyright. It would make no difference at all. But that's not what we're talking about. It's not a matter of patenting a specific program. The danger is that ideas that you can implement in programs will be patented. And this is a completely different matter. To understand what this means, the first step is to forget some confusion that you have probably heard in the past. You have probably heard people talking about, quote, intellectual property, unquote. Anything they said about it is confusion. The use of such a term is confusion, because that term was designed to lump together completely different laws that do completely different things. For instance, there is copyright law, which applies to works of authorship, and there is patent law, which creates monopolies on ideas. And there are other laws, such as trademark law and trade secret law, and they're completely different from each other. No two of them have very much in common. And they create different public policy issues. So the only way to think about them intelligently is to keep them completely separate in your mind. If you try to assume that something is true of copyright law because you heard it was true of trademark law, you're almost certainly wrong. And yet, when people invite you to generalize them, when they invite you to imagine that they are examples of some common, larger concept, then the most natural thing for you to do is assume they're similar. And every time you're going to be wrong. So if you think about, quote, intellectual property, you're not only going to miss all the real issues, you're even going to be misled about what these laws actually say and do. There is no way to think intelligently about, quote, intellectual property, unquote. And when people ask you to think about it, when people suggest that you should view issues in terms of that terminology, generally they are either trying to mislead you or they are misled themselves. So many people have been misled by that term already, and they will tell you what they think is the truth, but it isn't true. They have been confused by the term. Make sure you're not confused by the term. So think of copyright and patents as completely different subjects, And when you learn about one, never assume that it has anything to do with the other. And then you have a good start for understanding both of these issues separately. Historically speaking, copyright and patent evolved separately, which is why they have so little in common. To help you distinguish, I should mention some of the basic differences. A copyright applies to a literary work or some other kinds of things, but in general it applies to a work. And it covers the details, only the details. Whereas a patent covers an idea. Copyright covers copying. If you spend a year in a cave, and during that year you write a novel, and when you come out, it turns out someone else published an identical novel. If they try to accuse you of copyright infringement, you could prove it wasn't so because you were in that cave and you had no way of seeing the other person's novel. As long as you didn't copy, it doesn't matter if your words are the same because copyright only covers copying from someone else. But a patent is an absolute monopoly on using an idea. Even if you can prove that you had the idea on your own, it makes no difference because you're still not allowed to use it. Copyrights happen automatically. Any written work that's finished or that's published, treated as finished, is copyrighted. But patents are issued by a patent office in response to an application. The application costs a lot of money. And paying the law, that is, the application fee is a lot of money. But having lawyers write the application costs even more. Copyrights last an insanely long time. They can last more than 150 years in some cases. Patents last 20 years, which is not so long. But in the field of software, it's quite a long time. 20 years ago, there was no World Wide Web, and the internet was just getting started, and the PC was fairly new, and the Macintosh was new. So if you were limited to ideas from 20 years ago, there'd be very little that you could do that was useful today. The Economist once compared the patent system to, quote, a time-consuming lottery, unquote. And if you've ever seen publicity for a lottery, I'm sure you've noticed that they focus a lot of attention on an unlikely outcome that you win, and they never mention the probable outcome that you lose. This is a way that without directly lying, they can give you a wrong idea of what's likely to happen to you if you play the lottery. And so it's no surprise that the publicity for the patent system follows the same pattern. Most of the time when people explain about the patent system, they have a vested interest in it. They're part of the system. Either they work for the patent office or they are patent lawyers. Or maybe they're patent holders. So they always have a reason to want you to like the system. So they describe the system generally from the point of view of somebody who's going to win, who's already won. They invite you to imagine what it's like to walk down the street with a patent in your pocket, and every so often you could pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Give me your money." To counterbalance that bias, I'm going to explain what the patent system looks like from the other side, from the point of view of those who are endangered by it, those who want to develop software. but have to face the danger that at any time somebody might show up and pull a patent out and point it at you and say, give me your money. Imagine that you want to write a program and you know that your country has software patents. So you want to try to figure out under the system what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. The first step is to find all the patents that might cover the program you're writing. You can't do that. Because, you see, there are patents that are being applied for, and those are secret, at least for, in Europe, typically for 18 months. So, during that time, there's no way you can find out what's about to hit you. And this is not just a theoretical possibility, it's really happened, and it's happened pretty close to me. In 1984, the COMPRESS program was written, a data compression program. And at the time, there was no patent in the US on the algorithm that it used, the LZW compression algorithm. But then a year later, a patent was issued. The patent holder, Unisys, cunningly waited a few years before starting to threaten people. They thought, if we threaten them now, they'll just drop it. So let's get them dig their holes deep so that by the time we start to threaten them, they'll be good and stuck. This kind of tactic is very common, you have to realize. So they did that. And in the GNU project, we began looking for some other way to do data compression. Somebody came forward and said, I've got a program for data compression. I've been working on it for a year. I'll offer it to you. So a few months later, we were about to release it. And then I happened to see the New York Times on the day of the week of the weekly patent column. And it said that somebody had got a patent for a new way of compressing data. So I said, we better look at this. And of course, sure enough, it was the same algorithm we were about to use. So twice in a row. Well, eventually we found another algorithm that avoided all of the patents in the area. And that was the basis for the program GZIP, which is the way people normally compress data nowadays. I believe the version of GZIP that's used on Windows is called WinZIP, and so people everywhere are using this. But we had two hits before we got loose. So you can't find the patents that are maybe going to appear in the future. But you can look at the patents that are already issued. Those are published by the patent office. So you can find out about all of them. But there are too many of them to read them all. In the US, there are, I believe, hundreds of thousands of software patents. So it's a full-time job to keep track of them. So you're going to have to try to find the ones that are relevant. So you can search in various ways, and you'll find some of them, but you can't find them all. There used to be a software patent in the US covering natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. What does this mean? It means that no matter which cells depend on which cells, it will do the recalculation in the right order, recalculating each cell after the ones it depends on, so that everything is consistent. The first spreadsheets did their recalculation top to bottom, always, when computers were very small. And there was no room for anything smarter than that. Anyway, somebody asked me for a copy of this patent, so I sent it to him, and then he said, I think you sent me the wrong patent. This is something about compiling formulas into object code. So I looked back at the message I'd sent him, and I pulled up that patent number from our files, and yes, it said compiling a method for compiling formulas into object code. But it was the right patent. That was the patent covering natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. It didn't mention the term spreadsheet or natural order recalculation. But the idea described in the patent was the algorithm that you use to do natural order recalculation. It's an algorithm whose normal name in computer science is topological sort, which was first described in the literature in 1963, I believe. But the patent didn't mention the term topological sort either. The patent had dozens of claims, and each claim described a different way you could rearrange topological sort, trying to get them all. So if you had been searching for patents that might threaten or hurt your spreadsheet project, you wouldn't have found that one, unless you happened to hear the news that somebody else who had developed a spreadsheet was being attacked with it. However, you will find a lot of patents by searching. At that point, you've got to figure out what they prohibit, just what it is that you're not allowed to do for each patent. And this is hard because patents are written in twisted legal language where the words don't mean what you think they mean. The Australian government in the 1980s commissioned a study of the patent system, which concluded that the patent system didn't seem to do any good at all, and they recommended that if not for international pressure, Australia should abolish patents. But given the international pressure, it recommended that Australia make patents narrower in scope, harder to get, and last a shorter period of time. And it cited, among other things, that hardly ever did engineers ever read patents to learn anything about their fields. This is supposed to be one of the purposes of the patent system, so that ideas will get published. But they're published in such an incomprehensible form that nobody ever reads them except to find out the bad news. And they quoted an engineer saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." And I've seen personally that this is true. A while ago, Paul Heckel published a program, and then he got a couple of patents on ideas in that program. Now, I once spent an hour or so trying to figure out some simple way to describe what one of those patents covers. And I could not do it. You know, claim one of this patent was something that was rather complicated, and I couldn't find any simpler way to describe it. Now, when he first saw HyperCard, it didn't look anything like his program, so he never dreamed that his patent covered HyperCard. But his lawyer pointed out to him that the way the patent was written, it could be read as covering HyperCard. So at that point, he tried to squeeze money out of Apple. And then when that didn't immediately work, he threatened to sue Apple's customers. And eventually, I think he might have got some money out of them. I don't know. They generally keep the results of such extortion secret. Once when I was giving this speech, he was in the audience. And at this point, he jumped up and said, "That's not true. I just didn't know the scope of my protection." Protection is one of the propaganda words that supporters of the patent system love to use. It gives you the impression that somehow a patent is preventing a program from being destroyed. I don't know how a program would be destroyed if there are no software patents, but they want you to think that at an unconscious level. Anyway, he said that, and I responded, "That's exactly what I said." And at that point, he sat back down and had no idea how to respond. If I had said no, he probably would have argued with me. But he had no idea how to respond when I said yes. So, in order to figure out what each of these patents says you can't do, you're going to have to spend a lot of time talking with a lawyer, explaining your program, and having a lawyer explain to you what the patent covers, which methods. You have to explain various methods, and the lawyer will tell you this you can't do, that I guess you could do, maybe. Ultimately, the lawyer will say, if you do something in this area, you're almost certain to lose a lawsuit. If you do something in this area, there's a good chance you'll lose. And if you really want to be safe, stay out of this area. But keep in mind that there is a substantial element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. Now, at this point, once it's clear to you what the law allows you to do, what are your options? There are three things you can possibly do for each patent. One is try to avoid it. That is, don't use the idea that's forbidden by that patent. The second is get a license to do it. And the third is challenge its validity, try to get it overturned. Each of these may or may not be possible for independent reasons. So first, let's consider avoiding the patent. That means don't use the patented idea. This may be easy or it may be hard. For instance, sometimes an algorithm is patented. The LZW compression algorithm was patented. So we made another data compression program with a different algorithm. It wasn't so hard to avoid one patent, but there were dozens of patents in data compression. Avoiding them all was rather hard, but eventually we did it. We found another algorithm that nobody had patented yet. And so everybody stopped using compress and they all went to gzip. So we solved the problem, right? No. Because the same algorithm is also used in making GIF files. So, of course, it didn't take too long before people designed another image format which uses the gzip compression algorithm instead. It's called ping format, which I believe means pings, not GIF. And so we said to people, stop using GIF format, switch to ping format, help everybody escape from the trap of this patent. So look around on the web. How many ping files do you find and how many GIF files do you find? You'll find mostly GIF files. You see, the people who chose to use compress, they were people who wanted to compress some data. So if we said, don't use that compression program, use this one, they could do it. They wanted to compress their data, and they would choose whichever program seemed best to use. The people who are using GIF format don't start out by wanting to compress their data. They start out by wanting to make an image available in a format that other people use. So, you know, if you say, use a different format, they'll say, I can't. It took years to get the web browsers to support ping at all because they said, why should we bother? Nobody's using this format. Why should we go give any priority to supporting it? And the people who made images said, the browsers don't display this format. How can we use it? Each one was waiting for the other. What you're seeing is how hard it is to change a de facto standard for communication. Now, there are lots of standards for communication. Some of them are de facto standards. Some of them are officially published by a standards committee. And many of them are covered by software patents. GIF format was actually covered by two patents, both on the LZW compression algorithm. Now, this is not supposed to happen. The patent office isn't supposed to issue two patents on the same thing, but they couldn't tell. See, the reason they can't tell is It's hard to understand what a software patent covers, because it's just mathematics, really. So to figure out that two different patents or two different patent applications are really the same algorithm, you have to think for a while about both of them. There's no shortcut. You know, if these were chemical processes, they could see which chemicals go in and which chemicals come out, and they could get a quick clue, are these the same idea or not? But with software, there's no way to do that. So the people in the patent office didn't have enough time that they would ever be able to try to compare these two patent applications when they were both pending and see that they were the same thing. So GIF format was, but actually only one of the patent holders really went around threatening people. That was Unisys. The other patent is IBM's patent, and as far as I know, they haven't gone around threatening people. Well, we were all along, we thought, well, at least JPEG format is okay, but now there's somebody who has a patent and says it covers JPEG format and is actually suing a lot of companies for using JPEG format. The standards committee that published JPEG format says they think the patent doesn't apply. I guess we'll find out. But it gets much worse than that, because the MPEG-2 video format is covered by 39 different US patents. I saw a list. So it took longer to have the negotiation about how anyone could get a license for all those patents than it took to design the standard. And the people from the JPEG Standards Committee are saying that standards design is impossible now because of software patents. What's the use of having standards when you're not allowed to implement them? The LZW compression algorithm is also specified as part of the PostScript language. There are operators to compress and decompress. Well, we couldn't implement that. We could implement decompression because the patent, it turns out, only covered the compression side. But we couldn't implement compressing. And nobody ever found a way to another algorithm to make the same format of file and really compress it. Other compression algorithms make different files, different output. So you can't avoid a patent when it's needed to implement a standard. Now, sometimes what's patented is a feature. Around 1990, the users of the word processor Xyrite got a downgrade in the mail. A downgrade is the opposite of an upgrade. It takes out a feature. Xyrite used to have a feature that you could define a series of letters as an abbreviation. And then every time you type those letters followed by punctuation, they would automatically replace themselves with whatever you specified. So you could define CMT as committee. And then you could type CMT, comma, and it would turn into committee, comma. And then they discovered that somebody had a patent on this feature. And first they tried to negotiate a license with them, with that guy, but he kept changing his demands. And so eventually they felt it was impossible to negotiate with him, so they gave up. And they decided to take out the feature instead. That's why the users got their downgrade. But before they got there, they spoke with me. Because you see, I had put a similar feature into the original Emacs in the 1970s, many years before this patent. So for a while they were considering the possibility that with my evidence they could overturn this patent. But they decided that that was just too expensive and troublesome. So they took the feature out instead. Now, it's nice to know I have had at least one patentable idea in my life. So they avoided that patent by taking out the feature. And maybe users still considered that word processor usable. But how many features can you take out before the user starts saying your program's no good? If you look at a word processor today, you'll see hundreds of features. And each of those features contains at least one idea that somebody might have patented. So, to avoid all those patents, there may be a lot of features you can't have. Sometimes a patent is so broad that avoiding it is simply unthinkable. For instance, the entire field of public key encryption was covered by a patent in the US. And so essentially, almost nobody could do any public key encryption in the US. For over a decade, many attempts were crushed. PGP got away. PGP was released and started to become popular, and it took a while before the patent holder noticed this and attacked, started to threaten. And by that time, there was enough public sympathy for the developer of PGP that they felt that they didn't dare just go to court and crush the program completely. So they put restrictions on it. They negotiated a deal with him. He restricted the program to non-commercial use only, which didn't kill it, it just half killed it. So avoiding the idea that's patented may work, or it may not work, or it may be impossible. What about getting a license for the patent? Well, the first thing is the patent holder doesn't have to offer you a license. The patent holder can say, I'm shutting you down. And this happens. I got a letter from somebody once whose family business was to make casino games with computers, of course. And he was threatened by a patent holder who said, I'm not going to let you have a license. I demand you stop making these games. Now, I saw the patent, and it said it covered having multiple computers on a network where each computer supported several different games and could play more than one game session at once. That's it. The patent office thought that was an invention. You see, supposedly they will issue a patent for an idea that is new, useful, and unobvious. But in practice, that means unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 80. The most basic rule of computer science is if you've done something once, you could do it N times. If you've done one thing, you could decide to do N different things. But the patent office always thinks that doing multiple things instead of one makes something an invention. So I don't know how many different places there were before that patent was issued that put several workstations on a network and loaded up a few different multiplayer games.